Welcome to Interfaith Voices, the independent show exploring the religious and spiritual diversity of today's world. I'm Maureen Fiedler. Today we explore another aspect of the growing environmental consciousness of religious groups. A leading Quaker gives us a tour of their new green office building, the first on Capitol Hill. In the past, I have visited the offices of the Friends Committee on National Legislation on Capitol Hill, the advocacy arm of the Quakers, or Society of Friends. But I never had a visit quite like the one I had recently.
Now you're going to hear the noise of the geothermal system.
That's okay.
Let's come over to the pumps. So, as I said earlier, we have 10 wells 350 feet deep, and the loop for geothermal or ground-coupled heating and cooling system goes up and down those wells in a closed system. There is no exchange of fluid at all.
That was Joe Volk, the executive director of the Friends Committee on National Legislation, giving me a tour of the first green building on Capitol Hill, directly across the street from the Hart Senate Office Building. Part of that tour was a look at the geothermal system used for heating and cooling the building. For the record, it works well. The tour took place on a hot August day, and the building was as cool and comfortable as anyone could desire. The Quakers designed this office building to be as environmentally sensitive as possible. They are recognized leaders among the growing number of religious groups that are taking on climate change and preservation of the earth as a moral issue and responsibility. The genesis of this green building project began in the 1990s when the two old Civil War era townhouses the Quakers call home were in need of serious repair. They committed themselves not only to a green building, but to another issue of justice at the same time.
Our organization had lobbied very hard for the Americans with Disabilities Act in the late 1980s, and that was enacted into law in 1990. We were exempt from it because we're a religious organization and too small, but our committee said, let's make ourselves accountable to it, and when we do this building, let's meet the ADA requirements too.
For the Quakers, green building has nothing to do with being trendy and everything to do with religious vision.
Our committee has a statement of purpose that says, we seek a world free of war and the threat of war. We seek a society with equity and justice for all. We seek a community where every person's potential may be fulfilled. We seek an earth restored.
And I should say, as I came in this building, I saw stones outside with, in fact, those sentiments carved onto them.
That's right.
Quakers are pacifists, and they link this building to their quest for peace in the world.
We wanted a building that, when we operated it, would remove the occasion for war. And we know that the use of fossil fuels and the misuse of water has resulted in wars, and in future may threaten even more war. And so we said, let's build this building in a way that it will take us off of fossil fuels and in a way that it will help conserve the water resource.
But it's more than peacemaking.
We wanted a building that would fulfill Friends' testimony, that is our practice, on simplicity. And we wanted a building that would respect the integrity of God's creation and help to restore the earth.
And then there is the question of how a small religious group can have an impact.
There are very few Quakers in the United States, less than 200,000, in a country of 300 million people.
But they're a religious group that has been very influential for centuries on important social issues.
Yes, on free exercise of religion, on slavery, on dignity and equal rights for women, on human rights, and of course on war and peace issues. And what we said was, if we can do this as this small religious community on Capitol Hill, then there is nobody in the United States who could say, I couldn't possibly do this. It costs too much. I couldn't do it. It's too big a project. I couldn't do it. It's too complicated. No, look, we did it. If we could do it, you can do it. And if you do it, you'll love it.
Greening this building was not cheap. Special circumstances, the fact that they are located in an historic district, and the post-9/11 security concerns about any building on Capitol Hill escalated their costs to $3.3 million. But the Quakers saw even that cost in moral terms.
In this case, the Quakers said, we will pay the extra money to satisfy all these demands. We'll stay on Capitol Hill and we'll create this model of what could be, even though it's going to cost more. And this is part of our commitment to nonviolence. People who use nonviolence voluntarily accept self-suffering in order to reveal truth to the larger community. So we said, yeah, we're going to suffer by having to spend probably an extra $1 million to do this building, but that's part of the practice of nonviolence. And what we found was people all over the United States became excited about the vision and the project. They wanted to participate, and we were able to raise the money to do it.
Mm-hmm. Is it paid for?
It's completely paid for. We didn't start the actual demolition of the old building and the new construction until we had completed the capital campaign and raised all the money.
Now that the work is completed, the cost savings are substantial.
We have reduced the costs of operating the building by 45%. That is, if we had done a standard building, it would cost us 45% more to operate it.
So what goes into a green building besides the alternative power source of geothermal energy? A great deal, it turns out. First, there is the question of electricity. Since the geothermal pumps and the lighting in the building are powered by electricity.
There is one place where this gets tricky in terms of getting off fossil fuel, because we still need electricity for the lights, and we need electricity for the electric pumps for the geothermal system. Right now, the way we deal with that is we pay our power supplier a premium for wind-generated electricity. And so no gas, no oil, no nuclear, no coal is used for the operation of this building until we find a better alternative to that.
Probably the first thing that strikes a visitor is the light that pervades the building in every nook and cranny. And all this light has a religious significance for Quakers.
For Quakers, there is a religious experience of the light within. And we ask our architects to create a structure that would convey the idea of the light within.
The windows are double-paned for insulation. Even the interior offices have windows, and there is a light scoop on the roof.
One of the things architects who are doing green buildings want to do is use a lot of natural light in order to reduce how much energy they have to use to light the building. And as you can see, that light scoop drives natural light down into the building, even on a hazy day.
The floors are made of bamboo because of a concern for forests.
The reason we use the bamboo floors is that there are grass that can be renewed in 3 years. If we used a hardwood, it would be decades before that hardwood would be replaced, and yet the bamboo is just as hard as oak.
The flat roof is literally green, featuring vegetation with special functions.
You can keep the temperatures during the summer under 100 degrees, okay. So it helps a lot with the cooling. But in the winter, it helps with the heating, helps keep your heat in.
Water conservation is another part of the effort.
Low-flow toilets.
The elevator avoids the use of hydraulic fluids.
We got an electric elevator that works on cables and pulleys.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have runoff from hydraulic fluid, and you don't have to recycle old hydraulic fluid.
Anything that can be made of recycled materials is made of recycled materials.
The furniture is designed using recycled materials and to be recyclable when you're done with it. The tiles are high content of recycled paper.
These are the ceiling tiles.
The acoustical tiles on the ceiling. And then a high percentage of that is recycled newspaper. So we're trying in every way we can to use recycled materials. Now, when your audience hears this and when others hear it, they say, oh, there you are, ugly building. But if you look at this...
It doesn't look like recycled newspaper to me.
It doesn't, does it?
No, it just looks like white ceiling tiles.
Yeah, it's very attractive.
Parts of the old building that was gutted were recycled to make this one.
We recycled a high percentage of what we took apart, including bricks, concrete pieces, steel, things like that. And that's a part of the green process, is to reuse these old pieces.
There are even special environmental facilities to encourage employees to adopt personal earth-saving practices.
We provide, as you'll see right here, a shower, which is handicap accessible.
So you could jog to work and take a shower if you wanted.
You can jog to work.
Or bike.
Or you can, as I do, bike to work every day.
But the library has a feature that surprised me, and one that would certainly intrigue personnel directors in any business office.
One of the things you'll notice is a carbon dioxide sensor on the wall. It monitors how much carbon dioxide is in the room when people are meeting. And at a point where the carbon dioxide level gets a certain level, people will start to get drowsy. This will trip a little switch that will force fresh air in, which of course has oxygen, and take out the old air, and people will wake up, get more alert. We have this in both of our conference rooms, and it's been very effective.
So being green can help your staff and your employees actually stay awake.
That's right.
This does not begin to cover all the green features of this unique, cool, comfortable, and attractive building. But I wanted to know, have the neighbors been by? Members of Congress, that is, who are actually next door.
We have always been the ones who have gone knocking on the doors of Congress. After this building was open, we had the unusual experience of members of Congress coming over, knocking on the door and saying, I heard about this. I heard it was a green building. May I see it? Will you give me a tour? And as they were leaving those tours, they were saying, I'm going to go bring my colleagues back. We want to do green building initiatives in Congress. So this has been a very good legislative tool.
I've heard talk that there might be efforts to try to make the Capitol building itself more green.
Speaker Pelosi has given the chief administrator a mandate to green the Capitol. And he said one of the reasons he was coming over here to look at this was to see what kind of things we did might work over there.
It was a friend of the Quakers who summed up the special significance of this building.
We have been given some awards for this building by a chapter of the American Institute of Architecture. And in making the award presentation at the AIA, one of the remarks that was made was, many people have looked at well-designed buildings and commented on the way the building had a soul. This person said, this building not only has a soul, it has a conscience.
This radio tour of Capitol Hill's first green building has been led by Joel Volk, Executive Director of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. But you can take a virtual tour of the same building. Just go to fcnl.org and click on Green Building. That's fcnl.org. Partial support for Interfaith Voices comes from the Loretto Community, a religious community of sisters and co-members acting for peace and working for justice. On the web at www.lorettocommunity.org. That's Loretto Community, one word, .org. The Loretto Community, people of faith who are agents of change. Interfaith Voices welcomes commentaries on any subject that touches religion or spirituality in some way. Here is Reverend Bob Edgar, former General Secretary of the National Council of Churches.
Let us talk about immigration. But first, and I do know this is public radio, here's a word from our sponsor, the God of Abraham, Sarah, Hagar, Isaac, and Rebekah, Jacob, Rachel, and Leah. From the book of Leviticus, and I quote, "When an alien resides with you in your land, you shall not oppress the alien. The alien who resides with you shall be to you as a citizen among you. You shall love the alien as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." That seems pretty clear, don't you think? There are a half dozen similar verses in the Hebrew Scriptures, but Americans, who are so riled up over the immigration situation, seem to ignore these words. Many respected public opinion polls show Americans are willing to allow the undocumented workers already here a path to citizenship, but media and political demagogues would have you believe otherwise. They are trying to scare us. These are the same folks who trot out the very same Bible to damn gay marriage and justify anti-gay legislation in several of our states. But when it comes to more biblical evidence about how we should treat those non-citizens living among us, they are curiously silent. These fear-mongers are devilishly clever. They have used nearly every scare tactic to reduce us to a highly suspicious lot, all too willing to not love the alien as ourselves, to evict them from their homes, get them fired, or separate them from their families in an all-out rampage of opposition and prejudice. Nearly everything we eat passes through the hands of an undocumented worker. Nearly every office and restroom in America's corporate towers is cleaned and sanitized by undocumented workers. Immigrants have become the contemporary scapegoats. Higher taxes, crowded schools, infectious diseases, all have been attributed to those who have come to America without the proper papers. It's time we call it for what it is, racism. When you hear protests from vigilantes at rallies, they point to those who wave the Mexican flag. Ever been to an Irish bar or seen the flags at Columbus Day or St. Patrick's Day parades? White immigrants get a pass. Brown immigrants do not. Demagogues keep preying on post-9/11 fear to whip up suspicions of people who have come here in search of the same thing my Northern European ancestors were seeking. They want a better life for their families, more opportunities for their children, and to learn English. They already pay millions in taxes and contribute to their communities. The prophet Jeremiah tells us, if you truly amend your ways, if you truly act justly one with another, if you do not oppress the alien or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods, then I will dwell with you in this place. When I hear those words, I wonder about those who say America is God's anointed land, a shining city on a hill, a nation blessed by God. It seems before God will dwell with us in this land, we had better change our ways and truly act justly one with another, regardless of where we were born or the color of our skin. I'm Bob Edgar.
If you want to answer this commentary, or offer a commentary on any subject that deals with spirituality or religion in some way, email me at maureen@interfaithradio.org. That's maureen@interfaithradio.org. This week, we welcome two new people to the staff of Interfaith Voices. Our new producer is Laura Querrell, who comes to us with public radio experience in both Boston and Chicago. Our new assistant producer is Katie Jones, who comes to us with a background in religious studies. If you get only the first half hour of this show and want to hear the remainder, go to interfaithradio.org, where you can listen online or download our podcast. You could also learn more about our topics and guests, send us feedback, listen to past shows, or sign up for our free weekly email bulletin. Once again, that's interfaithradio.org. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 5031, Hyattsville, Maryland, 20782. Stay with us. Interfaith Voices is supported in part by the Interfaith Alliance, 185,000 members working from City Hall to Capitol Hill to preserve religious freedom and constitutional separation of religion and government. On the web at interfaithalliance.org. That's interfaithalliance.org. The Interfaith Alliance, protecting every American's freedom of belief. And now it's time for Celebrating Faith, a brief look at recent and upcoming feast days and various traditions. This week we have but one, a Hindu feast. For Hindus, September 4th is Krishna Jayanti, a festival marking the birth of Krishna, the most highly venerated god in the Hindu pantheon. He is usually pictured either as a young cowherd boy or a young prince giving philosophical advice to others. Next week, we explore the meaning of both the Jewish High Holy Days and the Muslim observance of the holy month of Ramadan. They come together this year on the calendar. What does that convergence portend? Might the coming together of these feasts offer some hope in the world? We'll talk to Jewish and Muslim leaders. Plan now to join us. I'm Maureen Fiedler. Coming up, a Labor Day conversation on farm worker ministry, Christian Scientists and universal health insurance, and the lasting legacy of Mahatma Gandhi. Stay tuned. There has been a long historic alliance between people of faith in this country and working people, especially those active in the labor movement. At this time of year, when we celebrate Labor Day as a nation, we like to remember the reasons for that alliance and catch up on the issues of concern to both groups. Joining us to discuss an important part of that alliance is Roberta Perry, the Southeast Director of the National Farm Worker Ministry. She is also a member of Florida Church Women United and is an active member of the United Church of Christ. Welcome to Interfaith Voices, Roberta.
It's good to be here.
Now, first, why should people of faith care about farm workers? What's the theological or biblical basis for farm worker ministry?
Well, there's many, many references to people who harvest, to the land, to the vineyards, to the food that we eat in both the Old and New Testament. But today it's particularly important because we, as one of the richest countries in the world, depend on people to provide us our food who cannot buy food for themselves. People of all faiths who believe in justice and caring for the earth and its people have to be interested in farm workers because they eat.
Who are the farm workers? How would you describe them as a group, at least the folks you know in Florida?
At this time, mostly farm workers come from Central and South American countries and the Caribbean or Caribbean, however you want to say it.
And what's their immigrant status generally?
Well, it's very difficult to count because it's very difficult to count undocumented workers, but probably a good percentage of them are undocumented workers who are brought in, sometimes under slavery conditions, to work in the fields.
When you say slavery conditions, what do you mean?
Well, we've had 5 convictions of slavery in the state of Florida in
Really?
The last 5 years, and they were people who were smuggled over here after paying a lot of money, having been told that they could come here and work and send money home to their families and that the land of opportunity was awaiting them. And they ended up in labor camps that were guarded. They worked without being paid. Sometimes they were paid in drugs and alcohol, if they were paid at all.
How many people were involved in that as victims?
I would say several hundred.
Several hundred.
I don't have the exact amount.
several hundred people in actual slavery.
Yes, that the convictions covered.
Now, of course, we know in general farm workers do backbreaking work when they are paid, which I assume is most. What are they paid and what kind of working conditions are common?
What we quote as average wages in farm work in Florida is probably around $8,000 a year.
And what's that come to an hour?
Well, that most farm workers work by piece, so they're paid per piece of everything they pick or harvest. They are supposed to, by federal law, make minimum wage. And if they don't make minimum wage at the end of the week, the difference in that, in what they got for the hours they worked, if it was under minimum wage, is supposed to be made up. Unfortunately, with 40,000 farming units in Florida and only about 20 inspectors, it's very hard to enforce those rules.
Mm-hmm. And how about their working or living conditions?
They're not much different than they were 50, 60 years ago.
Which not means?
Very little different than the harvest of shame that Edward R. Murrow did. And so a lot of them are very young men, and they live in houses or trailers, sometimes, you know, 10 or 12 to a trailer, and pay $50, $80, $100 a week per person to do that.
In that kind of space.
Yeah.
And I know there have been issues in the past about things like the use of pesticides in the fields or access to bathrooms, for example, or something that's a reasonable facsimile of a bathroom. Are those issues as well?
Yeah. I mean, Florida does have some of the best worker protection laws, but very few of them are in practice. And as far as the pesticides, there's even now a very active interest among farm worker groups to get some of those laws enforced, because even recently, as last year, women who worked in Immokalee in the tomato fields had babies with severe birth defects, and nobody's held accountable for that, even though it's widely believed by medical people that those things are pesticide related. It's a cumulative effect, so there's no accountability.
Now, you mentioned that a good number are probably undocumented, although I assume in many cases people just don't ask.
Right.
Are you hearing a lot of the anti-immigrant rhetoric in Florida that seems to be floating around the rest of the country? Or is it different where people know that the workers are needed, in this case for agricultural work?
We have had some of that backlash against immigrants, where the cities tried to pass ordinances prohibiting landlords from renting, you know, employers to hire people and that kind of thing. But fortunately, those ordinances have failed. You know, in an agricultural community, it is a different dynamic, because without the undocumented workers, farmers can't get their crops picked. So farmers are also in favor of comprehensive immigration reform.
I understand you've had one positive development in your area, an agreement between McDonald's and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, Immokalee being a town in Florida, to address the wages and working conditions of tomato pickers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the McDonald's agreement followed an agreement with Yum Brands that owns Taco Bell that increased the workers' pay a penny per pound. That one penny per pound increase for 32 pounds of tomatoes in a bucket, which was an average of about 40 cents, went up to about 70-something cents. And so it pretty much doubled, almost doubled the workers' wages. But that McDonald's agreement and the Yum Brands agreement do something that the workers feel is even more important, and that's the sense that they have a voice at the table. There's a grievance procedure. There's a way for them to have input on the pesticide issues, the housing issues, mm-hmm. and that's the most important thing. And Burger King is being asked to jump on the train and do the same for the tomatoes that they buy within the state of Florida.
Are they likely to do that?
I believe that they will, because it's right. The same religious and faith coalition and unions and civic organizations that supported the Taco Bell boycott and the McDonald's campaign are also trying to communicate with Burger King. I mean, there's a whole coalition of religious leaders in Miami.
So you have religious people actively involved promoting what would be the well-being of some of the poorest paid workers in the state of Florida.
Yes, very actively.
I assume that they're also involved in preaching or communicating with the people in the pews on this.
Right, and many times it's coming from the people in the pews up to the leadership.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, people travel to Immokalee to do prayer vigils with workers. Workers go to local churches when invited for worship and to explain. The simplicity of the issue is that workers who have been treated like equipment need to be treated like employees.
And if people wanted more information on the Farm Worker Ministry, your website is?
It's www.nfwm, as in National Farm Worker Ministry, .org.
All right, that's nfwm.org.
Yes.
Roberta Perry is the Southeast Director of the National Farm Worker Ministry, a member of Florida Church Women United, and an active member of the United Church of Christ seeking justice for the farm workers in her state. Thank you so much for this Labor Day conversation, Roberta.
Oh, I was glad to do it. Thank you.
Still to come, how do Christian scientists view the call for universal health insurance? And what is the legacy of Gandhi in India? Stay with us. A lot of presidential candidates and others are talking about the need for universal health care in the United States. Former governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, worked with Democrats in that state to pass a bill requiring all citizens to have health insurance, with subsidies for those who cannot afford it. Others, like Democratic candidate Dennis Kucinich, back government-sponsored, single-payer health care, and still others, like candidate John Edwards, favor plans that are a blend of the two. But one question rarely addressed is this. What about people who do not believe in standard health care? Christian scientists, for example. Should they be obliged to buy health insurance in Massachusetts? And if a single-payer government health plan were established, how would they feel about that? Here to discuss this question with us is Phil Davis, the manager of the Committees on Publication for the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to Interfaith Voices, Phil.
Thank you so much, Marty.
First, briefly, explain for us what Christian scientists believe about standard medical practice and standard health care.
Well, I like to think of Christian science, you know, as a religion of choice. It's about individual choice for health care, and it is obviously a turning to God. It's a turning to prayer. But I just wonder if I can first give you an idea of what Christian science is about, telling you a little bit about me, at least one story I can think of that might illustrate this best. There was a time when I was on an all-terrain vehicle going through a campus at too fast of a speed on rolling hills, went up into the air and came down on the small of my back, heard a crunch and a pop and terrible pain. And, you know, I could have called 911. I had a choice in front of me. There was a way to do that, but instead I chose prayer. I turned to prayer and I was quickly healed. The fact is that I know that I'm not alone, that there are others who make this choice too. And it is a choice. It is not something that is the result of a biblical prohibition. It is not something that the church tells us what to do. But it is a choice that one makes because you see effects from it. The fact that I found quick healing as a result of turning to God and realizing God is divine love, ever present there, is what changed the picture for me, and it changed it physically.
Am I understanding you correctly that Christian Scientists are not forbidden to go to a regular doctor if they chose?
Not at all. And I am a Christian Science practitioner, one who prays for others, and it is something in which I have found myself not only in their homes and them in my office and on the phone helping through prayer, but I've also been in the hospital. I have sat long hours with individuals bedside in hospitals, and it is something that is not a prohibition. It is not really a negative choice on the part of a Christian Scientist to try to stay away from something. It's a very positive decision that a Christian Scientist makes to turn to God.
All right, and I noticed on your website you also have something called Christian Science Nurses as well as practitioners. What do the nurses do?
A Christian Science nurse provides the kind of physical care without medical treatment, without medical devices. This would include the bandaging of wounds, mobility, keeping the patient clean, but again, without medical.
Now, how did the Church of Christ Scientist respond to the Massachusetts requirement that everyone purchase health insurance? Is this something you lobbied against?
We rarely, if ever, would lobby against a bill in the legislature, and this includes Massachusetts. Our effort is always to make it better. And one way that we make it better is making sure that the residents of any state, including Massachusetts, would have the ability to choose their own health care. That would include spiritual care and treatment. So we wanted to be sure that the law and the subsequent regulations would allow for that and make sure that the residents would have that freedom of choice.
And do they? Does the law say that?
Well, it does provide what is called a religious opt-out, that if one has sincerely held religious beliefs, they don't have to have health insurance. But that really doesn't cover a lot of individuals to have health insurance and to make sure that spiritual care was provided for.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are still working with both regulators and insurance companies to make sure that provision exists.
I'm wondering then if you can satisfy the requirement by creating a kind of Christian Science health care plan, which could then be used to pay your practitioners or nurses, for example.
Well, that would lead one to feel that it was just about our club of people called Christian Scientists, but this is really for the public because there are others who would turn to spiritual care and treatment. They would look to prayer. There is, in Christian Science, both practitioners and nurses, it is a system of care and treatment. It is a charge for it. It is not the government paying for religion, but it is making sure that insurance companies have the ability to allow the people who are covered under their policies to have access to spiritual care and treatment.
So for you, is this an issue of religious freedom?
I see it as really a freedom of individuals to choose the kind of health care that they want and to make sure they continue to have access to it. When government programs go into effect, it can reduce or restrict one's ability to have access to the health care of their choice, including spiritual care. And, you know, our whole country, America, is really about opening possibilities. It is about expanding possibilities, not shutting them down.
Mm.
So we want to be sure that for everyone's sake, that spiritual care and treatment is included.
Well, now, of course, we have some government health care programs in the United States right now. SCHIP for children, for example, Medicare,
yes.
Medicaid. How does a Christian Scientist view those?
Well, we work with these different programs. One that you mentioned, Medicare, does contain a provision for Christian Science nursing facilities. We will work with any government program to find a way to make sure the public has access to spiritual care and treatment.
And how about Christian Scientists in Canada, where there is a government program of universal care? Is that how Canadian Christian Scientists relate to it?
Well, there is no provision right now in Canada under the single-payer system. It is something that we are working with the Canadian government. We would love to do that.
So if you had your druthers, how should a law be written that would establish universal health care, still respect your beliefs, but not have the government pay for what some people might perceive as religious practice rather than medical practice?
It's a very good question, and that is something that should be discussed. How can we do this in a way that it would not be crossing that barrier of church and state, but still allow for the provisions to be there so that individuals have freedom of choice, have the ability to make the decisions that they feel will be best for their health care.
And if people wanted more information on Christian Science and spiritual care, what website would you recommend?
ChristianScience.com. That's probably the easiest one to recommend, ChristianScience.com.
Phil Davis is the manager of the Committees on Publication for the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Phil.
Thanks so much for having me.
Partial support for Interfaith Voices comes from Call to Action, an organization of Catholic laity and clergy working for justice, inclusion, and accountability in their church. On the web at cta-usa.org. That's cta-usa.org. Call to Action, a voice for justice in church and society. Sixty years after leading India's revolution, Mahatma Gandhi is known worldwide for his political impact. He's less famous for his deep spirituality, which he considered to be the foundation of his politics. But Gandhi was no fundamentalist. In fact, modern India owes its constitutional secularism to the staunch religious tolerance of the man called the Father of the Nation. Despite these beginnings, though, waves of fundamentalism from both Muslims and Hindus have continued to rock the country with increasing intensity. Gandhi may be turning in his grave, but there are still people maintaining his vision of tolerance and working to promote interfaith understanding in a land of many religions. Anil Mundra reports from Maharashtra, India.
I do dimly perceive that whilst everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is underlying all that change a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates. That informing power of spirit is God.
Mahatma Gandhi was born into a Hindu family in Western India, and this upbringing would be the bedrock of his life. The Hindi word Sanatani means orthodox.
He called himself a Sanatani Hindu, orthodox Hindu.
Thakur Das Bung lives in the community Gandhi founded called Sevagram, or the Village of Service. It was from this little hamlet in the plains of central India that Gandhi won the nation's independence and lived the last 12 years of his life until he was assassinated by a Hindu militant in 1948.
He said that I am a Sanatana Hindu, and therefore, I am also equally a Muslim, a Christian, etc.
Bung lived in Sevagram during the last years of British rule and Gandhi's life. The village was a laboratory for Gandhian values, including that of religious pluralism, and his conviction that all religions simply show different forms of a single God.
He regarded that all religions, one form or another of God. Now, in that case, how can you have a religion which regards itself as superior to other religions?
Gandhi established this ideal at Sevagram through the daily prayer, which included verses taken from every major religion of India. They still recite it at Sevagram twice a day, while hand-spinning their own cotton yarn, an act of great political and spiritual importance for Gandhi and his followers.
It begins with Buddhist religion. text is Sanskrit Gita, Gita,
which is a basic text of Hinduism.
Third is the Quran.
Allahu Samad, Lam Yalid Walam Yulad Walam Yakun Lahu Kufuwan.
Fourth is the Christian Bible.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
Fifth is Parsi Pilgrim.
Known in the West as Zoroastrians, who form a small but influential minority in India.
Then the next one is Sikh religion. And the last one is Jainism.
Namo Siddha.
This ecumenical prayer guided Gandhi's life and his community.
The different good things which he adopted or which he borrowed from all the religions, he could amalgamate all of these into 11 vows. They form the ethical foundations of Gandhian thought.
One of the vows is equality of religions, says Bharat Mahoday, the director of the Institute of Gandhian Studies down the road from Sevagram. The Institute propagates Gandhian thought through research, degree programs, and community outreach. An interfaith camp, for example, brings the public together with experts on India's five largest religions.
We choose every year a theme, and we ask scholars of these five different religions to address the audience and the students what is the view of their religion on that theme. For example, once we organized this camp, and the theme was fundamentalism. So they spoke on Islam and fundamentalism, Christianity and fundamentalism, Hinduism and fundamentalism, like that.
But Gandhi knew that this kind of instruction must begin early in life, and so he placed basic education at the top of his agenda.
Education is for the future man in his adulthood or in social life. So this is the way to make them.
That's Shiv Dutt at the Basic Education Council, an organization housed inside Sevagram, just a few feet from the hut which still holds Gandhi's bed and his trademark wire-rimmed glasses and walking stick. The Basic Education Council runs their own primary school as a training ground for Gandhi's values.
We tell them a story of every religion's good man's story. There are so many good things, not only in one religion but others. We tell them there is no difference between Hindu and Muslim, and so this value, every religion has an equal respect of us.
The Basic Education Council sees this as an essential condition for a healthy society.
Particularly in a country like India, it is very necessary one, because there are so many religions in India, so many languages are there, so many cultural differences are there. So if we don't respect any other people's activities or religion, then we cannot live peacefully in India.
Shiv Dutt takes this message on the road with the Shanti Sena, or Army of Peace. The Army of Peace goes straight to sites of religious conflict, working to diffuse tensions and change negative attitudes.
I found so many people who were saying, I hate Muslims. I will kill them. Then I start arguing them. Why you want to kill them? Why? So by this way, we try to convince the people. So if it is removed by step by arguing them and giving them fact and true things, they can be soft at least, if not totally converted.
They took their message to Gandhi's home state of Gujarat, just after Hindu-Muslim riots there killed over 1,000 people, most of them Muslims. And in the ashes of the dying conflict, they discovered a private tolerance hiding below the public strife.
People were saying, no, we don't want these riots and all this. When we told that every religion is the same, everybody was saying, we know it, why are you telling it to me? We know it.
Gandhi's religious tolerance is maintained by organizations outside Sevagram as well. One of these is the India Peace Center, an interfaith trust jointly created by the National Council of Churches in India, the Catholic Bishops' Conference of India, and the Gandhi Peace Foundation, with help from the YM and YWCA. Its director, John Chaladure, says that they learned from Gandhi that, while engaging with others, a community must thoroughly search its own soul to be sure that it approaches different religions with sincere respect and openness. Chaladure has brought this process to his own Catholic Church.
The Christians will sit together to assess their own stand vis-a-vis plurality. Do we really believe in plurality? Do we really? If I don't recognize Hinduism, if I don't recognize Islam, going for dialogue is really a self-deceiving exercise, and also it deceives others.
But Gandhi always said, truth is God, and God is truth. And so for him, a deceitful dialogue is a faithless one. For Interfaith Voices, this is Anil Mundra.
You've been listening to the sound of Interfaith Voices. We welcome your comments, feedback, suggestions, ideas, and prayers. For audio online or our podcasts of the show, visit our website at interfaithradio.org. If you want our free weekly email bulletin or want to offer a comment on the show, contact us through interfaithradio.org or write us at P.O. Box 5031, Hyattsville, Maryland, 20782. Interfaith Voices is produced by the nonprofit Faith Matters of Brentwood, Maryland. Our producer is Laura Querrell, and our assistant producers are David Castro and Katie Jones. Our engineer is Margot Kelly. Original music by Mark Stenson. Join us next week to hear more Interfaith Voices. I'm Maureen Fiedler. This year, the Jewish High Holy Days and the Muslim Holy Month of Ramadan come together on the calendar. Is there reason for hope in that convergence? I'm Maureen Fiedler, host of Interfaith Voices. Join me next time when I ask Jewish and Muslim leaders. That's Interfaith Voices.